welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pappe Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. And they've got everything John Deere up there. If you need a tractor, you need implements, you need mowers, you need zero turns, they've got them all in stock right now. Go up and see them. Their inventory is really good. They've got full parts and service. If you need something repaired, they can jump on that right now. Or give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226. I'd love to hear from you. And you can also
get them on the web at pappemachinery.com.
That's right.
So today is October the 8th. This is a continuation, kind of our program with Dr. Judith Curry from October 1st, 2023, in case we replay this on a different time in the year, because this is really basically timeless. I don't see the climate change people getting religion any day soon and figuring out that a lot of what they're pumping is silly. And I don't necessarily see the return to science coming. But, you know, things always do change. So who knows? Maybe scientists that actually do real science will be popular again in my dreams. She has written a book. It's called Climate, Uncertainty, and Risk, Rethinking Our Response. I saw it on YouTube, so it must be true. Someone said she's a climate heretic, which I was like, well, she's our new best friend. She must be awesome and amazing. She was a climate denier, something or other. We're climate deniers. She had a better title. She has a PhD, so you know, when you're a doctor, you get a better heretic name than we do. I forget. She is the co-founder of Climate Forecast Applications Network, CFAN. Her website is judithcurry.com. And I would really, really encourage you to go take a look. She's got great information there. And cfanclimate.net is her company, cfanclimate.net. And we've got all the book and everything linked up for you on the website. I was looking at so before I forget, what kind of a heretic are you, Dr. Curry? You're a climate – it was long. It's kind of a title.
This is going to be in 2010.
Okay.
The Scientific American published an article. They did a pretty big interview with me, and I got, you know, all my points across, and they had this photo shoot and a makeup artist and the whole works. I said, okay, wow, you know, I'm really glad that I can get my perspective out there. So what do they title the article? Judith Curry, Climate Heretic, Turns on Her Colleagues.
Oh, nice. My God. And for that, you needed a makeup artist.
Right. Well, I think the author might have been more well-meaning than the editor.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That happens sometimes.
Okay. But
wow.
Basically, this was following, I don't know if you've heard of Climate Gate, which was the emails. Yeah, okay, you've heard of that. Well, this was following that. What I had done is I had called out, you know, these scientists in a gentle way and say, look, you need to be more transparent about your methods. You need to make your data publicly available. You need to be more honest about uncertainties, and you need to lose that overconfidence. It isn't scientific. And finally, you need to be respectful of the people that disagree with you, particularly when they're research scientists who have different perspectives or you know, new evidence. You know, you shouldn't just try to cancel them and insult them. So, you know, that sounds like motherhood and apple pie, but boy, was the climate establishment upset with me.
Oh, yeah, because all those things are super unpopular. I know that.
I mean, I dare to criticize the IPC, you know, the UN climate assessment and all these important people, you know, and, you know, and wasn't, you know, so people, you know, didn't know how to deal with me. Okay.
Get rid of her. That's always how they do it, isn't it? Like, make you shut up. Isn't that the...
Well, they called me, you know, then they say, okay, well, let's just call her a denier.
Name calling. I forgot about that.
throw her into the camp of crazies, and then we can just, oh, she's a denier. We don't have to listen to anything she says. So they tried that. I don't think it worked too well because, you know, my science remains very sound and fairly prolific.
Facts are stubborn things, you know. I mean, when you run around and write a book like Al Gore did, and every single thing in the book didn't happen, you know, facts, even though he wrote a book and flew all over the world and tried to make everybody believe him, still didn't make it true.
Yeah, that's true. You know, so it's not about science. It's about the social aspects of science. You know, who's important, whose voice is heard, who gets the media attention, who gets the grant money, you know, so forth and so on. Not about the real scientific arguments or evidence.
Not about getting to the bottom of the issue. It's a little bit like bad policing, right? They decide who did it and then make all the investigation make that person guilty, but never really look for who did the crime. I mean, I think everyone would agree that's a terrible way to solve. Yes, someone went to jail, but was that the right someone? This is just the really, really big version of trying to solve a mystery. And they've decided, you know, who the criminal is, CO2. And, well, it's us, really. I'm lying. It's us, and we're using CO2 to destroy the world.
It's even worse than that. They decided on the punishment.
Oh, that's true. You know, I forgot about that.
You know, get rid of the fossil fuels before they even really figured out the
That's
crime.
Right. They strapped us to the electric chair before they laid out the charges. I forgot about
that. Right.
Literally, the electric chair. Huh. Interesting. We should bring that back. So your part two, the uncertainty part. I like your title, the climate change uncertainty monster. So what's hiding under the bed with the uncertainty monster?
Okay, well, this comes from the idea of the monster. It's the interface between society and technology. It's a Dutch philosopher who came up with this sort of monster framework. Okay, and so then there was another Dutch social scientist who took it to the monster at the interface between science and policy, you know, where facts versus values, you know, how to communicate it, fear versus opportunity, and all these different dichotomies. And so I said, climate science uncertainty monster, you know, that this is my little theme here. And it's really about how we have monster coping. Okay. So a couple ways you can deal with the uncertainty monster. You know, you can try to hide it. Okay. And this is like an example of this is, you know, Michael Mann and his hockey stick trying to, you know, hide the uncertainties and squash anybody who talks about them. You know, then you have...
That really worked well.
I mean,
you got to hand it to the guy. That was a pretty quality plan.
Yeah.
They're still clubbing us with it.
Yeah, and then you have monster simplification, where you get a bunch of experts in the room, and they manufacture a consensus, and this is what the experts say. Okay, so that's sort of...
That is kind of a good point.
You know, that's another thing that we see. And then uncertainty monster elimination. And this is like, well, more research and we can get rid of the uncertainties. Well, when you have a hugely complex system like the climate system, well, we do more research and we just figure out more things that we don't know. I mean, we do increase our knowledge base. But the things that we don't know, you know, the world of that becomes even larger. Then you have monster detection. You know, you're trying to figure out what we don't know, you know, what the uncertainties are. And that's sort of what my book is about, is sort of like a monster detection thing. And the other thing is monster assimilation. Just saying, okay, there's a lot of things that we don't know. And
let's be
many
friends.
Of these things that we can't know. Okay, so now what are we going to do? You know, so, and this is sort of the risk and response section of my book, which talks about, you know, how we assess risk and how we can manage them and how we make decisions under conditions of deep uncertainty. So that's the sort of the third part of the book is really monster assimilation, if you will, into, you know, we have to, you know, we need to abandon the idea that we can control pandemics or that we can control the climate. Instead, we need to work to understand and then figure out how to manage the impacts. And in a way that, you know, is we have low regrets in terms of what we do. I mean, this whole net zero thing is something that is what I would say a non-robust decision, because if it turns out that human-caused climate change is not much of a problem, you know, we've destroyed our economy and spent a lot of money on wasteful things, and we could have been dealing with real problems. So that's the uncertainty monster, and it sort of pervades parts two and parts three of my book.
Yeah. Yeah, we've more or less put the response ahead of the horse.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, anybody who's, you know, fixed anything or remodeled, I mean, remodeling is a good example. We remodeled a house, and we got to this one part, and they had paneled the living room. They had changed around, you know, the structure. The front door was no longer where the front door was. And where the old front door was, there was a paneled over, you know, the whole room had been paneled over. Then they painted over it, so you didn't really notice it was paneling at first. Then we started looking at it, and it's like, wait a second. That other room has a part of the wall that's, like, pushes into the room. So there should be a space on the other side, but it's flat. Like, wait a second, there's like a room. They've paneled over a space. And so it's like, well, we got to cut that open. And so Bill and I like went back and forth. Bill's like, we're not cutting that open. And I go, I'm not living in a house where I have a whole big space in there and I don't know what's in it. Like, I want to know what's in it. Bill's like, what if we cut it open and it's like a dead body or something? I'm like, I don't know, but I'm cutting it open. We got to cut it open. And so we went back and forth on this thing. Like, do we leave it alone? Right? Do we just paint the room and just go about our lives? Or do we need to know what's in the space? Well, you know how that worked out. We cut it open. But it's really weird. Like, there is nothing that you do in this life, including raising children, raising dogs. Everything has uncertainty to it. And you cannot. It's impossible to go through your life and not address it. Like, you...
Well, you have to acknowledge it. And, you know, and people figure out how to manage little risks, you know, about being careful when you cross the street, or the more mundane risks. And this leads us to figure out, you know, how to deal with bigger risks. But when you have, like, these real complex system, I call them wicked problems, you know, the economy, pandemics,
yeah,
you know, climate
change,
all this kind of stuff, like, you can't control. We just need to abandon the idea that we can control. That's one of the key messages from my book. But there's still a lot that you can do, you know, to make us less vulnerable to whatever might happen, be it with pandemics or climate change or the economy. And so we have to figure out, you know, how to reduce our vulnerability and make smart decisions that are adaptable. You know, as we learn more, as conditions change, we need to be able to adapt and change our response. You know, and as new technologies become available, new information becomes available, we need to be able to be flexible. I mean, you know, and all of this sounds like common sense.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, gee, what's up with that?
Yeah,
more heresy, I'm sure.
Yeah, common sense is very uncommon when it comes to these kind of problems, because people want power and control, and you know, they seize on these issues as a way to achieve those objectives, and that gets us into a lot of trouble.
Well, but you know, even like, in my remodeling problem, you couldn't just ignore. You had to go one way or the other. You always have to go one way or the other.
And, but I think it's important.
And with this, to just pretend that there is only one way is just not...
Let me defy logic. You can hedge. First, you could have got maybe some sort of x-ray machine to try to see what's in there, thermal imager, see what's going on. You could have maybe drilled a little hole and try to look in and see what's going on. So there's some incremental things that you could have done.
Of course.
To try to figure out what's going on before you took the big jump.
But you still had to put your foot in it, you know. You still had to go.
Right, you had to take a baby step. So this is my point, is to start with baby steps.
Yeah, you don't have to change the 100% of the course, but to not even acknowledge that there's, you know, that the road less traveled, there's never one way to do anything, really.
Right. You look for the win-win situations. Okay, in the climb arena, and this takes us into part three of my book, I mean, find the common ground. Nobody disagrees about doing more research and development for better energy technologies. I mean, of course we want something better than what we have, you know, by the time we get to the late 21st century. Nobody disagrees on that. Nobody disagrees that we're too vulnerable to extreme weather events and that we should figure out ways to reduce our vulnerability through infrastructure, through better emergency management, through whatever. I mean, so there's things that people can agree on. Okay, focusing on solutions or policies that make sense, then that sort of bypasses the whole issue of what's causing climate change. We don't need to agree on that before we do sensible things like R&D for energy technologies and reducing our vulnerability to extreme weather events. I mean, these are things that make sense. So that's an example. And the bad thing is that focusing on climate change has distracted from dealing with real environmental problems, you know, like pollutions and habitats and species. And, you know, a lot of what we're doing with wind and solar is just terrible for the environment.
Yeah, it's impacted. These one-way solutions have really impacted the things they claim to care about.
I know. You know, in the 1970s, you know, when Greenpeace was just getting started, their big cause was save the whales.
Yep.
Okay. And now look what's going on off the mid-Atlantic coast. We've got all these whales dying because of the sonar and all the crazy activity going on offshore to install offshore wind, which is a totally bad, not to mention insanely expensive solution that just simply is not going to work for a whole host of reasons. And in the meantime, we're killing hundreds of whales. And Greenpeace, you know, is completely mum.
Nowhere to be found. This. Yeah.
Well, yeah, we're going to set up another date with Dr. Patrick Moore, who started Greenpeace and then left. And I remember back when we spoke with him years ago that he said that the reason that he left was because they were they wanted to ban chlorine. And he was like, all right, that's it. I'm out. They were just fundamentally unserious. Got to take a quick break. We're going to come back. I forgot we had to take a break. I thought we already did it. Gosh, time flies. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Tell me who to be.
How much fun would it be the next time the IPCC meets, you just like slide that in and it starts blasting out of all the speakers? Who made you king of anything?
Let me hold your crown.
So Dr. Curry, on the risk side of the climate debate, I mean, that's a huge list. It's got to be a huge list. What's at the top for you? Like, I guess it depends on who's asking.
In terms of what's the worst thing that might happen?
Maybe. I guess if you had to put it in some sort of like crazy order. Is there such a thing?
Okay. The worst thing that could happen,
yes, there is such a thing,
is a partial collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet. Okay. The West Antarctic ice sheet is unstable. If you took away the ice sheet, you know, the continent would actually be well under sea level. Okay. So it's a hugely thick ice sheet, and because it's grounded below sea level, it's unstable and it moves fairly fast.
Yeah, because it's like miles thick, isn't it?
Yeah. And so there's, whenever you hear, oh my gosh, an iceberg the size of Rhode Island just broke off, well, that's usually coming from the West Antarctic ice sheet, and it's not an uncommon occurrence. I mean, these big icebergs, ice islands even, you know, just leave the continent, you know, with some regularity. The question is, well, is global warming making this worse? Well, conceivably a little bit, but it's really, if this were to collapse, it's more likely to be, you know, associated with geologic processes. There's a lot of geothermal heat and even volcanoes in these parts of the West Antarctic ice sheet. If that was to become more active, that would make it more unstable. There's also the ground beneath is rising. Something that's not quite understood is to why it should be rising so fast, and so that colors our perception of instability. But when people talk about tipping points or something really crazy and bad that could happen, that's probably at the top of the list. And the collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet, which would raise sea level by a few meters over the course of a couple of centuries. So that's probably the worst that can happen. But in all honesty, natural climate variability and geologic processes are more likely as a potential cause than global warming. After that, you know, I don't see a heck of a lot to be concerned about. You know, the past 150 years have seen really quite benign weather. I mean, you know, people, our climate is, you know, and all the warming, you know, the 2-degree target and all that kind of stuff that the UN folks talk about, that's relative to pre-industrial, you know, about 1750. Well, the 18th century, the 1700s, were a terrible time. I mean, it was towards the end of the Little Ice Age, which was the coldest period of the past 1,000 years. I mean, think George Washington and Valley Forge. Mm-hmm. That was, you know,
never
really
talk about
cold.
The food or the weather.
Right. And in Europe in the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, the weather was just so bad, so cold. There were famines and just, you know, it was just horrible. And they were drowning witches because they were blaming them for bad weather. You know, in the same way that now we blame fossil fuels for bad
right.
weather.
But the bad weather back then had nothing to do with human-caused.
Oh, no, it was cold.
They were driving their wagons too fast.
Right. My point is that the weather tends to be much worse when it's cold.
Mm-hmm. And, oh, yeah.
You know, and so they reference the current warming to this very cold period. Well, you know, like it was some sort of Goldilocks climate, you know, back in the 1700s. Well, it certainly wasn't. So it's just another sort of nonsensical thing. Mm-hmm. You know, like if we pass 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees, it's the end of the world.
I don't want to zoom by that. Wait, is that why they think, is that, I, apparently I don't study this enough. That's the frame of reference. They think everything was so great then.
Yeah, pre-industrial, before humans started influencing the climate.
And so, we've got to get back to that because it was so fantastic?
Well, I don't think...
Wait, I'm sorry. How do you make a serious argument about that?
Well, it's not easy. It's not easy. But it becomes enshrined in...
You got to fly to a foreign country on a private jet and sit around with a bunch of people who only think like you, I guess.
Yeah, it's not quite... And, it's political, and people say, oh, well, science tells us what this target is. It does. The scientists had nothing to do with it. This was purely a political decision.
Poor science gets blamed for everything.
These targets to maximize the pressure. If the target's too high, well, people say, oh, later. And if the target's too low, it looks hopeless. So it's carefully calculated to maximize the pressure for action. I mean, it's totally a political decision.
Wow. It's as random as it feels.
So there really is, I mean, if you were to sit down with them and say, okay, pick a time period that was the perfect climate and we'll shoot for that, what would that time period be?
Well, again, climate is regional.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, where are you? And how do you make that be the whole world?
Exactly. So it's, with any climate change, there's winners and losers. But why do people think warming's bad? In the U.S., people are migrating from Illinois and New York to Florida and Texas and Arizona because they hate cold winters. So what's wrong with a warmer climate? But then you talk about, in the Middle East, oh my gosh, it got to some crazy temperature. Well, they know the temperature's really hot there, and in the wealthier countries, they're wealthy because they have a lot of oil money. Everything's air conditioned, and they do just fine.
Yeah.
And people work at night. A lot of, a lot of athletics and work, outside work, occurs at night when it's cooler. They've just adjusted their schedule, around that. So, this is the weakest part of their argument, that sort of warming is dangerous. And if you take the extreme weather events out of the equation, which have little to anything, to nothing to do with warming temperatures, you're just left with the slow creep of sea level rise and some glacier melting. And it's hard to make that sound very dangerous.
Right. Well, I remember when Dr. Moore spoke about the bleaching of the coral reefs and kind of, don't tell him I said this, but he went a little crazy. He started kind of ranting. And he's like, that's just ridiculous. You can't bleach a coral reef. He's like, it's the plankton. And he kind of went into what makes the color on the reef. He's like, coral doesn't have color. Like, oh, I guess, I didn't think it was really happening, but after he explained it, it really wasn't happening. And I felt bad for him. I'm like, scientists must be so frustrated right now.
Corals are a dynamic ecosystem. They have natural die-off and they have natural periods where they thrive. And most of the publicity has been about the coral reefs off Australia. Well, right now they seem to be doing fine.
Oops.
A couple of years ago they weren't doing so.
Let's not talk about that right
now. That doesn't feed into the more bad news scenario. That's the funny part. Like, things that do well, it's like, shh, we're not talking about that. Like, that's not a thing today.
Oh, exactly. They cherry pick to only talk about the bad things. So have you ever heard that extreme cold events cause 9 times more deaths than extreme heat events?
No.
I haven't heard that, but I did grow up in Connecticut, and so I am aware that, winter is a little little tougher. Just if you're going to look from a kid's perspective, like getting to school in the winter. We had these huge ice storms, and, pipes froze and stuff happened, and we moved from there to California, and it was kind of like, okay, well, nothing happens here. honestly, it was all pretty flat line here. It got warm. It got cool. But nothing like there. You didn't have any of the...
Yeah, but it still gets cold there. I mean, nothing's really changed in the last...
Yeah, I mean, we got rid of all of our, you know, wool sweaters. You didn't... I mean, you had to have some serious cold protection when you live in a place like that. You don't dare, like, get in your car without being prepared. Like, what if your car broke down and you had to go walk somewhere? You can't just go take off in your dress-up clothes and go somewhere. You've got to always be prepared for things. It's harder to live in those climates. It takes a lot of planning and a lot of consideration for the cold. Like, here, you're just going to get all sweaty, you know. Right.
So this whole notion of dangerous, you know, it's about values and it's very subjective, and our perceptions of risk are often very misguided.
Yeah, I think your monster thing is really appropriate because it is portrayed a wee bit like a monster. And then you have like I got a thing this last week. The Biden administration report admits green energy subsidized more than fossil fuels. And I thought, that's not shocking. But I was kind of, I guess, I don't know if I was surprised by it, but the numbers were staggering. From 2016 to 2022, renewable energy sources received $83.8 billion in subsidies, while fossil fuels received $24.5 billion. You look at that, you think, let's see, who's going to innovate more? Who's going to be more in the forefront? Who are they going to try to make us buy more products from? You know?
Exactly. I mean, particularly wind turbines, they aren't economical without massive subsidies. And especially the offshore, people are bailing on the offshore wind just because, you know, the costs are so humongous and the subsidies just aren't sufficient. So wind turbines are just very uneconomical to build. Solar is cheaper. It's still not cheap, but it's definitely much cheaper than the wind turbines.
But like where they put them, you know, they put all those solar farms in the Midwest and then a giant hailstorm comes.
Yeah. Oops.
Epic fail. Goodbye, solar panels.
This is one of the big contradictions.
Yeah.
So the reason we don't want global warming and we want to get rid of fossil fuels is allegedly so we can get rid of bad weather.
Yeah,
okay.
Right.
So then
it's
they make
fundamentally unserious.
Yeah, wind and solar and even hydro that fluctuate with the weather. We have wind droughts and solar droughts. If you have a forest fire, you're not going to be getting any solar radiation. With the big fires in Canada, apparently in New York, it really knocked out the solar power quite a bit. So why do we want our power supply
to be all one way?
To be vulnerable to extreme weather. I mean, it's just crazy.
Yeah, none of that makes any sense when you delve into it. But the problem is it's almost like when the music's up too loud. You know, it's really hard to think. It's a little bit like that now with the whole narrative of this, because you're just bludgeoned with it everywhere. I'm sorry, we have to take one more quick break. Our guest is Dr. Judith Curry, and we have done two shows with her, October 1st and October 8th of 2023. I hope you'll listen to them both. Super informative, gives you lots of information to speak with with the true believers in your life, maybe share it with them and might give them pause for thought. You can find it at wethepeopleradio.us.
Give a man a free house and he'll bust out the windows, put his family on food stamps. Now he's a big spender, no food on the table, and the bills ain't paid, cause he's spending on cigarettes and PGA. They'll turn us all into beggars, cause they're easier to please. They're feeding our people that government cheese.
You'll never shine if you don't glow. Hey now, you're an all-star. Get your game on, go play. Hey now, you're a rock star. Get the show on, get paid.
And all that glitters is gold.
our guest, Dr. Judith Curry, right there in a nutshell. Only shooting stars break the mold. Yeah, you absolutely are an all-star in this field because, well, for starters, you tell the truth. That's kind of a biggie. And you do tell it in a way that is understandable. You know, a lot of times science can be confusing, which doesn't give us regular people many tools. So,
well, I mean,
thanks for catering to the regular people.
Well, you know, it took me a long time to figure out how to do that. I started it like around 2006 or so. I became very intrigued by the blogosphere, you know, which was a very big deal, you know, back around that time. And I started going around to a bunch of different blogs and commenting, you know, a range of blogs from the alarmist blogs to the skeptical blogs and just engaging with people. And, you know, I was invited to write some guest posts and whatever. But that really helped me develop my communication skills and my ability to write to a very broad audience. And in 2010, I started my own blog, Climate Etc., JudithCurry.com, where, you know, a big part of what I'm doing is try to communicate in a way that works for a broad audience. I'm talking about, you know, not the QAnon types, but, you know, people who have a sincere interest, maybe have a college degree, but a smart high school student should be able to understand it too. You don't need to be an expert or a specialist to understand this. And what I found is that a lot of people who are educated in technical fields outside of climate science became very interested in this field and began applying their knowledge and their expertise to investigating things, and they would write guest posts on my blog. And so, you know, I was able to develop this little community, you know, with a broad range of expertise, and it provides a forum for people across the spectrum, so to speak, to come discuss, debate, question, disagree, argue, do whatever.
It's just really important because those of us who, I mean, have any common sense at all, you look at, just you listen to some of this stuff and you go, all right, that can't be real. You know that there's something haywire with it, but you don't necessarily have the scientific background to go after it. And you have managed to pull those things that the rest of us spot right away and then say, well, this is what you're looking at. This is what you're looking at. And it's really helpful. You also have a part of one of your, in Chapter 11, you talk about the applications of the precautionary principle. Maybe in our last little bit here, would it be cool to go through a little bit of your risk management and your precautionary principle, because you include the COVID deal in there, and God knows we all got an education there.
Okay, well, again, and this
in skepticism,
goes
I should say.
Yeah, this goes back to 1992. Remember the preventing dangerous human-caused climate change?
Right.
And the precautionary principle was enshrined at the Rio Earth Summit maybe a year or two before, you know, that we don't need to have full understanding, but we should prevent it anyways, just in case. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, which works fine for something simple, like what if somebody comes up with, okay, red dye number 2 looks like it causes cancer. Well, how sure are we? Well, we're not that sure, but what the heck? We don't need red dye number 2. Let's just use, you know, beets or something like that if we need the red color. So it was a simple problem. You can easily find a replacement. Well, what we're talking about in terms of CO2 emissions is that there's no simple, quick replacement for fossil fuels. And so this precautionary principle is like at the root of these targets, 2 degrees, 1.5 degrees. And it's a really bad match for a really complex problem like climate change or COVID. swinging over to COVID for a minute, like when in that first month, like I started hearing about this, I guess in January, you know, what the heck is going on? And I was trying to, you know, garner any information that I could. And in the very early days, there was so much uncertainty. We knew that this was going to go global. We knew that people were going to die probably a lot, but we didn't know a heck of a lot else. So in case of like clear and present danger, you know, a short period of applying the precautionary principle until we can figure out what's going on made a certain amount of sense. In March, when they started lockdowns and preventing people from traveling and stuff like that.
Sure.
So that makes a certain amount of sense. But by the time April and May rolled around, we started to have a lot more information, like it was the elderly who were dying and, you know, things like that. There was still confusion about transmission modes, but we were starting to learn a lot. And by the time it got to be June, you know, we knew it was more transmitted through the air. We didn't have to keep wiping every single surface we touched. You know, we started learning a lot, so we didn't need to be, and we knew it was the older people. And so keeping those lockdowns, keeping those mandates for, you know, even longer a year made no sense, and what we ended up with was a cure that was much worse than the disease in terms of very adverse impacts on children who weren't able to go to school, young children who weren't able to see anybody's face, and their speaking, you know, was slowed down. Old people who couldn't have, you know, who died without being able to see their families, cancer patients who didn't get treated. There were so many adverse impacts of these lockdowns. So that's an example of precautionary principle gone haywire. You know, the precautionary principle, it's different than precaution. Okay, caution means you have to be careful of danger. Like, and we know that it's dangerous to cross the street, so we look both ways. So that's like a cautionary thing to do. Precaution is when there's scientific uncertainty. Okay, so climate change and pandemic qualify, and precaution, taking caution, even though we don't know everything, makes sense. But the precautionary principle is sort of at a whole different level. It's about really mandating a solution, a precaution, without any regard to anything else. You know, to other values. Well, people want their freedom. They want an easier life. They want economic development. They want, you know, all sorts of other things. They want to go outside. They want to travel. So that's the precautionary principle, is sort of when the notion of precaution goes haywire. Again, it's suitable for tame problems like red dye number two, but not for climate change. And so at most, the precautionary principle tells us, you know, we have a problem that justifies some response. It doesn't tell us what the response should be or the magnitude of the response. So it's a complete mismatch to really complex societal problems like COVID and climate change. And so having the global policy of, you know, eliminating fossil fuel is another example of precautionary principle run amok. You know, it completely neglects that people need energy and want energy, and we're slowing down development in places like Africa. We're messing with our food supply. We're redirecting all the development funds into CO2 mitigation funds, so we're exacerbating poverty. We're slowing down a sort of industrialization and infrastructure because of steel and cement use CO2. We're messing with the food supply through worrying about cow farts and fertilizer. from ammonia that requires fossil fuels. So we're doing all sorts of stupid things that are making us much worse off while we're not, you know, we're degrading our energy infrastructure. And through all this, we're not doing anything to the climate. I mean, we're not going to have any kind of a noticeable impact. You know, like in the 22nd or 23rd century, we might see a slowdown in the rate of sea level rise, but that's maybe about it. You know, so why are we doing this? Well, because it's become, you know, it's part of the UN agenda, and now, you know, the national politicians have chimed in.
The grant money is at an all-time high.
Yeah, the
government cheese is coming out in blocks that are too large to carry.
So you've got the scientists on board, you've got the businesses on board, on and on.
Universities.
All, you know, supporting, you know, it's become lucrative and professionally useful.
And in what you're seeing out there, what would be, it's not going to be one thing maybe, but where does the failure tipping point actually kind of either slow the roll or turn this back around? Like how much of this has to not come true for them to maybe back away?
What I think is going to happen is that people are going to realize that wind and solar don't work, and they're going to turn to nuclear, which is a really good solution. I mean, it takes time, it costs money, but it's a really good solution. So I think people are just turning in that direction.
And the new forms of nuclear, you know, because a lot of people, hear that, they freak out that, oh, my God, it's super dangerous, 3 Mile Island.
Well, they're doing really good research right now on fusion energy that has no byproduct. And there's no real downside to fusion.
But they can clean the nuclear now and not have big
stockpiles. They can reuse it.
So both.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
They can store it. They can reuse it. Yeah, the Generation 4 nuclear power is wonderful. The modular reactors and molten salt and all these new technologies are just wonderful.
What do you see with the fusion?
we'll see. I mean, in principle, it's wonderful, but in practice, it's pretty much nowhere. So I don't know how long it's going to take for fusion to be a viable power source. I really don't know. But it's not on the near-term horizon, that's
no.
for sure. Technology is the answer. And once we have good technologies in this whole political, good energy technologies in this whole political debate goes away. But you know, a lot of people made their career on this. You know, all these NGOs, these organizations, scientists, and companies even who have, you know, bet the farm on this being a huge, crazy issue. They're going to be disappointed, you know, in 10 to 20 years when, you know, this is, remember when we used to care about that.
We laugh about the 1970s with the, you know, with the global cooling. You know, it was the ice age was coming. That's what they told us.
Right.
Like, did you know that was stupid back then? I mean, were you looking at that going, oh, for God's sake, they're telling people this?
Yeah, well, the 70s, I was still a student, and I wasn't really, you know, I would see it in an odd magazine. Oh, that's cool. you know, we have a lot more to fear from ice and cold than we do from warming. So, you know, people and the best antidote to whatever Mother Nature has in store for us is to develop wealth and reduce our vulnerability to extreme wealth, to extreme weather. I mean, if we have money, we can afford desalination plants. We can afford safe infrastructure. We can, you know, develop reservoirs for our water resources so we can better manage them. And, you know, we have endless energy and information systems and all sorts of data and artificial intelligence, which will keep us informed and safe. You know, what's not to like? But all that requires economic development, and energy is sort of the is what fuels economic development. So, I mean, this is what we should be focused on. But, you know, the money, you know, from World Bank and various UN organizations that used to go to economic development in Africa and other underdeveloped nations is all being redirected to CO2 mitigation.
Which is dumb.
And anything
we have yet run out of time again. The news is going to cut us off, Dr. Curry. We've been on with Dr. Judith Curry. You're listening to We the People.
You know there ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay, we got mouths to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down, we can't hold back. Though you know we wish we could. I know there ain't no rest for the wicked until we close our eyes for good.